Good evening.
Good evening.
And welcome to The Talking Show.
Yeah.
On K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro broadcasting radio station.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Nicholas Miller, and I am here as always with the inimitable.
Thank you.
Stephen Cato. Why don't you
thank
say
you,
hi,
thank
Steve?
You, thank you, thank you. It's nice to know that I remain inimitable. Thanks so much.
Wow. Yeah, and Steve was looking extra ripe today. Did you hit the squash course today, Steve?
Oh, as always, yeah. It's I feel like in these troubled times, it's all I can do is play squash. I have nothing else to offer the world. This is just what I can do, mediocre squash.
Right.
Yeah.
From what I hear, you squashed one of our good friends this past week on the court. Is that true?
Yeah. I'm destroying. I'm an animal.
Excellent.
I'm killing it.
Great stuff. Don't want that talking show tally to slip on the squash.
No, man. I'm killing.
You're
talking about the game here?
It's been a weird week, eh?
Yeah, it has. I tune it all out. I only play squash. Every now and again, you know, I hear something. The wife brings something up, tells me what's going on. But in general, I just try and focus exclusively on squash. It seems really messed up from what I can see, but I just don't pay attention anymore. I just don't listen.
Trump is wasting no time with implementing his lunacy.
That's what I hear. That's as I understand it. However, like I said, I have no idea. I have been exclusively devoted to Coach Philippe and learning and right. Understanding squash. Yeah.
Yeah, that immigration policy, or not even policy, just that immigration yell. What's an executive order? It's just like a big yell.
Yeah.
is really terrible. But you know, in lighter news, one of our former guests on the talking show appears to be building a tunnel between Beverly Hills, Bel Air area and LAX.
Mm-hmm.
So all of you wanting to go to LAX to protest soon enough, former guest Elon Musk will have a traffic-free way for you to get there. Isn't that wild?
You know, I know that he prides himself on doing the science, but I have read that planners say that if you add more capacity, you don't necessarily get less congestion. You just encourage people who had previously felt like the 405, the 105 was too gross to drive on, and therefore were taking flyaway shuttles, you know, airport buses, ride sharing, that these people now were going to, because the congestion was apparently lifted by this offset tunnel, just increase the usage to fill the capacity, and therefore sort of eradicating any congestion alleviating situations surrounding LAX, which is, you know, horrible to think about. Like, basically, there's no solution. There's no way to win. You're just doomed. It's just going to suck over there forever. Anyway, so I hope Elon does his due diligence here.
Yeah. I mean, Elon doesn't seem like a jokester. And if anyone could just kind of preemptively build a tunnel under the 405, if anyone had the means, it'd be Elon.
That's true.
I know Caltrans is a little nervous.
Yeah.
Kind of waving their finger saying, hey, you need a permit for that, which, you know, if Spielberg were saying it, I don't think they'd be as worried.
I mean, I think, You do need a permit for it. Do you remember how there's that story about how when they were building the first Wilshire subway, they were going to put it all the way out to La Brea, I think, but then they hit a natural gas pocket with the drilling machine and it blew up a Kmart. Did you, do you know that? You remember that story? No? Anywho, that is a thing.
Speaking of Steve Spielberg, that leads us pretty cleanly into our guest tonight. It's a thrill to have him here, all the way from the west side of Los Angeles, where he lives. I know many of our longtime listeners in the audience raised a brow when they saw him walk in, because those dedicated listeners know that we are not great fans of music here on The Talking Show. This is a show for talking. There are other shows on K-Chung where you can hear music, like Too True, directly before this program. Talking Show is not a place for that stuff. But I want, rest assured, everyone, rest assured, tonight's guest will not be doing what he does best. In fact, tonight's guest is just going to be talking. So, for those of you out listening, I won't keep you in the dark any longer. Tonight we have the one, the only, Hans Zimmer.
Amazing musicians out there, but you have to cast them like actors. I mean, on Inception, for instance, I was writing this, I had written this tune, and I had a sound in my head, and I didn't know, I couldn't quite identify the sound. And after three days, it took me three days to figure out what I was hearing, and it was, all I was hearing was Johnny Marr playing the guitar. But it wasn't because it was a Fender guitar through a Fender amp and anybody could do it. It was specifically Johnny. And it's a really simple tune. And I think people don't really realize this. The simpler the tune, the more you actually hear the musician. I mean, one of these days I want to go and do a study of the Fender Strat, the Fender guitar. Everybody's got one. Everybody sounds different on it. It's like DNA, or it's a great way to see fingerprints. Everybody has an individual sound, And so if somebody's trying to sound like Jeff Beck, they'll never sound like Jeff Beck. And it's amazing that if you let that personality come through, and if you actually encourage that personality, it just makes it all better. But I'm very specific at writing for certain musicians. I mean, in the orchestra as well. When I write a cello line for the orchestra, there's a cellist I have worked with all my life, chap in London called Tony Pleath, who's an amazing cellist. And as I'm writing, I see him play it in front of my mind's eye. So, yes, I'm very specific. I'm very specific about that. Moving to England, being in England, and Mr. Jackson would encourage us to embrace culture, and we would go up to London to go and see concerts, which of course my mum thought was Beethoven and Schubert, but we went to see the Rolling Stones and we went to see David Bowie. So yeah, and you were suddenly in the thick of things, you were where music was being. Not just music was being made, but the zeitgeist of music at that time was really happening. It was the late 70s, it was the beginning of the 80s. So, it was this, now I can only think of the German word, Wendepunkt. The sort of the cusp between, whatever that thing was in the 70s, Yes and Genesis and the Sex Pistols and the Clash. So I got both of it, and then I got film music. I mean, I remember going to see Close Encounters of the Third Kind and just thinking that John Williams had written one of the great sort of symphonic poems of the late 20th century. I thought that was as fantastic as, anything Richard Strauss had ever done, the other Munich composer, as we like to think of him. No. But... So there was a hustle and bustle, and then there were commercials. England was a fantastic place in those days because it was a grim place. It was, you know, Margaret Thatcher just got into power. So the coal miners were forever on strike. So economically, it was, and politically, it was a very precarious period that young people in their own way sort of started to rebel against. And I think one of the things that happened was Channel 4 started to come out. And I had these friends that worked at Working Title, for instance, you know, and Channel 4 would let us make movies. Or I was friends with people who were making commercials, you know, Maggie Rodfin and George Martin, and he gave me my first job, really. And suddenly we were doing commercials, and commercials in those days were directed by Ridley Scott and Tony Scott and Alan Parker and people like this. So they were of a, you know, there's a high caliber of visual art going on, and the same with music. I mean, one of the first commercials I did was for Nick Rogue, you know, I mean, and through other people I got to work, you know, Stanley Myers, I got to work with Nick Rogue quite a bit. So it was a great learning curve because the times were really exciting. All technology, you know, all technology influences our life all the time, you know, and the thing is to make sure that the technology doesn't rule your life, that you can go, and that was the thing, you know, when I started, they were very simple. There were these simple little things, you know, it had, you know, an oscillator and a filter, an amplifier, an ADSR. I mean, there were like four components to the thing, you know. And that's quite a manageable thing. And with those four components, you could go and make all these different sounds. Then, of course, I discovered recording studios, and there was a whole other synthesizer in itself. And the idea, and it was very much an idea of the late 70s and 80s, that a recording studio is an instrument in itself, a musical instrument. And the thing I think we were very, or I certainly was very aware of, because by not being a good performer in front of people, I started concentrating more and more on doing recordings. And a recording is a very, very different beast from a performance. I mean, when you go and see Oscar Peterson, Jeff Beck, it doesn't matter who it is. When you go and see them perform, the music sounds different than when you hear the recording. I remember seeing Alfred Brendel play, and then buying that concert on a CD, and the note lengths were different. You know, the actual performance was a different performance, because, you know, when he let go of the note, visually I heard the end of the note, but maybe the decay of the note had already happened much earlier. So, you know, I very quickly realized that doing a recording was a different thing from doing a concert or having... it was a different way of presenting music, and it became really interested in, you know, what recording can do and what the technology could do. So yes, and it was a brilliant time where technology in recording and technology in music was advancing at a sort of a rapid rate. You know, every week there was something new which we could try, destroy, play with, whatever.
A guy from the Buggle said that you were the only one who could program synthesizers in London.
that's probably not true that I was the only one, but, you know, I was one of the handful, 3-4 people, you know. You know, for instance, like Buggles is a good example. Jeff Downs was a great player. I was a good programmer. So together, you know, it's like, who cares how you get there? We managed to make a great racket together, you know. And there is something about that collaborative process that happens in music all the time. I don't know where, I can't really think of where else that really happens. That thing that can only happen with eye contact, and when people are in the same room and they start making music and they are fiercely dependent on each other. They, you know, they cannot sound good without the other person's part. And just taking this a little bit further, and it's really people like George Martin, Quincy Jones, who started you know, that the record producer suddenly became part of the creation of this music, you know, and then the recording engineer. And so the circle widened a little bit. And, you know, one of the first things we did, I mean, one of the advantages just we synth players had, we could be behind the glass where the recording engineer was. We didn't have to be out there, you know, and there was this horrible wall, the glass between you and the communication. But, you know, again, you know, like how Jeff and I worked or how Trevor and I worked was, you know, it didn't matter who pressed the key and who twiddled the knobs, but, you know, there was this organic way of coming up with these sounds, and these sounds would lead to ideas, and these ideas would lead to songs. No, the possibilities, you know, even before then with the Mellotron, that you could go and somehow capture an orchestra digitally or... And it wasn't really, it was never about imitating an orchestra. It was more about creating the emotional experience of an orchestra, which didn't necessarily have to rely on having 100 people in the room. You know, which, yeah, you know, with technology, it became really quite simple to do. The downside of course, is that you don't have 100 people in the room anymore. And from then to now, I mean, I've really started to appreciate what it means that the one thing that you can't electronically recreate is the spirit of 100 people aiming their emotion in one direction. And that's, you know, that's the magic of a real orchestral performance. But I never, you know, for me, there was never, as German as I was never that dogmatic the way people were about, you know, that, for instance, synthesizers didn't fit into an orchestra or vice versa. If it made a noise, if you could play a tune on it or even whatever, half a tune on it, it was a musical instrument that was, it was a piece of technology. I mean, don't tell me a violin isn't a piece of technology. It's just a technology of a different century. So it might have just been blind ignorance that stopped me from having those prejudices against, you know, if it made a noise, use it, you know, make music with it. Stanley was the brightest human being I ever met. I mean, really, an amazing knowledge of music and orchestra and how it all worked and, you know, the academic side of things. And at the same time, he was a great inventor and a great experimenter. And he sort of took me on because I think, you know, he liked that I knew how to make his coffee machine work or something like this. And he liked those weirdo electronic things. And I think he liked the way I was thinking. You know, and at the same time, it takes, you know, and I only realized that years later, it takes a very, very generous spirit to go and teach this kid who all he knew was like his four rock and roll chords about the orchestra without being, you know, patronizing. And he let me write straight away, you know, partly out of pragmatism, because he didn't like writing car chases and stuff like this. So I got to write a lot of car chases. But partly because I think he just thought it was interesting what I was doing. And then, you know, we would show our music to the director. And the beginning, I don't know how many movies. It was just amazing, because everything Stanley had written, they would love, and everything I had written, they would hate. But he would never say, oh, Hans wrote this, or I wrote this. And even when they said I hated it, he wouldn't say, oh, it's his fault, which was quite a surprising thing, you know? I mean, that sort of grace. And, you know, again, this is the thing. I mean, and then suddenly I was writing things that they liked. And that you do get better at it. And you do have to start somewhere, and you do, you know, and you have to be lucky in life, and you have to find somebody who lets you have this period of writing terrible music and lets you grow and lets you mature a bit and lets you get better at it and encourages you and shows you how to do it better, partly by example, because, you know, you'd, I remember one of the last pieces Stanley wrote, it was actually for Harry Gregson Williams. Harry had asked him to write a piece for something, and Stanley didn't want to write it. You know, and Harry kept nagging him for this piece, and then finally Stanley just took a piece of paper and he wrote 8 bars and of something, blah, 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 and then directions underneath it. And the directions were, okay, first time play it forward, second time play it backwards, then the third time you take it from the middle and you play both sides out, then you go and... And it was, I don't know how long it was, but it was a good 10-minute piece done in 8 bars, and it was just a brilliant crossword puzzle, but when you played it, it was an amazing emotional piece of music, you know. And those were just some of those sort of Stanley things, you know, that where your jaw would just drop, because and I think the thing he taught me, I think the thing that he really taught me was, you gotta have a tune. If you don't have a tune, you have nothing. You're just grazing, you know, like cows in the field. And so getting back to your Dark Knight thing, I mean, Dark Knight is one note, and then the Batman thing is really two notes. So a tune doesn't have to be a lot of notes, but you, it has to have purpose, and you have to know why you're doing it, and you have to have thought it through. You know, it has to be somehow intellectually defensible for it to resonate emotionally. You have to know what you're saying. And Stanley always knew what he wanted to say musically. So starting to talk about Power of One, and I had this idea that the whole score, because it was about Africa, and I hadn't really done an African score. World Apart is not, you know, it's very European. But I wanted to do this thing of using Zulu choirs and do it just with voices. And I started recording it here in America and not really knowing the difference between gospel church and Zulu choirs. It started to sound more and more like a R&B soul revue, you know, like, and I'd spend a lot of money, I spent a lot of time, and it just wasn't working. Nobody was telling me it wasn't working because I hadn't let anybody listen to it. And I finally had the courage to go to Warner Brothers and to the producer and say, you know, look, I think I'm making a mess here, and I think we should go with their original idea, which was, you know, can we not make it more like Out of Africa, big string section and stuff like that. And the producer said, no, I actually think your idea is really good. The mistake you're making is you're not in Africa. And that was on a Thursday, and by the Monday I was standing in a studio in Africa. Well, it wasn't a studio, it was a warehouse. You know, yes, and you know, sometimes what is great here is, and I think it's a very important part of the creative process, people encourage failure here. You know, I mean, I'm failing completely on this Power of One score, and I want to go and take the easy option out, and somebody else goes, no, hang on a second, your idea's good, your execution is bad. You know, but we're believing in your idea, and we're going to see it through to the bitter end, whatever that means, going to South Africa. So, because I don't think you can go and create without having somebody watching your back and doing what on the surface seem like insane ideas and seeing them through. And people are really good at backing you, you know, watching your back and letting you try those ideas. Of course you repeat yourself, but it's, you know, it's not a conscious repetition. It's more like, there's a certain style, you know, that everybody has, of, let's call it a voice. you know, and I don't know if one is born with it or if one grows into it or whatever, you know, and then at the same time, things change. I mean, I can't imagine writing a Gladiator score again, you know, out of no other reason than I said everything I could say on that subject then, and I tried to do it as well as I possibly could. So, you know, you lose a little interest in writing, you know, Wagnerian heroic themes or something like that. Yes, you know, there are certain chord changes and there's certain, like, the way I finish a phrase, it's just me. It's just, you know, and sometimes I sit there and I know, wow, this is a, you know, I've done that sort of thing before, and you try to reinvent it, but then you go, but no, hang on a second, there's just this little fragment, it's like my signature, you know, and it's, I don't know, do painters get criticized for painting the same still life the same way? Or do filmmakers get criticized for, you know, having the shot? I mean, that was the 80s thing, wasn't it? You know, the shot of somebody welding and all the sparks flying. I mean, how many movies were like this? Or, you know, the that every movie these days is orange and taupe as a color spectrum. You know? So you know, yes, you know, you're always trying to do something new, but at the same time, I don't consciously try to work within my style. That's why I shift my projects so radically. You know, going from an Inception to a Jim Brooks movie is a very conscious choice, because you know it's a bit like having a good sorbet before, the filet starts up or something. I thought one of the things nobody's ever going to get about the movie is that Russell's character is this Maximus, is the Spaniard, you know, and there's a very, very dodgy bit of geography that goes on, that he goes from Germania back to Spain, Iberia, in four shots or something like that, you know, and so I thought, you know, the obvious choice was it was going to be a guitar, Spanish guitar, and I remember that the journey, I really wrote for Hator, so I wrote him like a mini guitar concerto, and the other guy I got in, because the movie does this wonderful arc from Germania through, you know, Spain, North Africa. We don't get to Rome for so long, it's sort of great, you know. So the North African thing, and I kept writing for this other musician, Jivan Gasparian, who lives in Yerevan. He's Armenian. He plays the duduk, and I kept talking to Ridley about this and everybody. It's such a sad sound and such an ancient instrument. Except he was in Yerevan and I was in Los Angeles, and the producers kept saying, you know, Hans, come on. You're not going to go to Yerevan. You don't have time for this. I hadn't even spoken to him, you know, he doesn't speak English either. But I kept writing for him, you know, and finally even Ridley, who really encourages me to go, you know, finally Ridley said, you know, maybe it's time to think about something different. And I was heartbroken. I didn't know how to get hold of him though. And I get a phone call from Michael Brook going, hey, Hans, have you heard of Jivan Gasparian? He's coming into town tomorrow to rehearse with me for a tour. You know, and I just knew, you know, if you write it, he will come, sort of thing. And poor Michael, I mean, I instantly stole Jivan away from him. They never got any rehearsing done. They still did the tour. And the only thing I knew about the duduk was that you should not write in D, but I had written everything in D because it's comfortable for me to write in. And he came in and he doesn't speak a word of English. I don't speak Armenian, obviously. He's got his nephew with him. He comes with a big bottle of vodka, just iced, and, you know, as it melts, you know, we drink, so, you know, and I start playing him some stuff. You know, as the ice melts, you see on the inside, it's a photo of him. It's, you know, that he's a national hero in Armenia. And then we're playing, you know, I'm playing him my ideas and he's playing along. And after about a few hours, I go, oh, but it's all in D minor. And I say to his nephew, but oh, I thought you can't play the Duduk in D minor. And he said, but he's Jovan Gasparian. You know, and that's why you get these people, because they're so good and they're so amazing. And you know, after a week, my Armenian wasn't any better, and his German or English wasn't any better. But the great thing about music is you just play. And that's, you know, we had no problems communicating. That was entirely Pietro Scalia and Ridley, you know, their idea to have that, you know, to just have a beautiful piece of, you know, the aftermath of the battle. And the way the battle is structured is, I mean, even cinematography, it keeps going lower and lower and lower until you're sort of, you know, in the mud. And the music does sort of the same thing. But it just felt like there needed to be something very heartfelt at the end of it. Gladiator is a really undisciplined score because there, I kept searching for, I had like a main theme, but nobody was really excited about this main theme. So, you know, it was a little disappointing at the time, if you know what I mean. So I kept writing new themes, and then, you know, you'd get to that bit, and that tune you only hear once in the movie. You know, Commodus killing his father, you only hear that tune once in the movie, and I think there's something like 19 main themes in the movie. But it worked, you know, because the tone, I think, was very consistent all the way through. Even though, you know, it's like, there's a whole Wagner section in the middle, you know, there's like, you know, blatantly, I just went, you know, Siegfried Funeral March, you know, I'm just going to go and embrace that and go and see what I can do with it, etc. So, you know, this heroic idea that then ends in this very simple Lisa Gerrard thing, you know, that you have all the pomp and circumstance, the Leni Riefenstahl bits in the middle, you know. I mean, I'm not saying it's any good, but I'm saying I was surprised how easy it was to channel this sort of Wagner thing. You know, it's like, I was literally there sitting, you know, the entry into Rome, it took me minutes to write, it took me forever to orchestrate, but it took me minutes to write, and I was literally going, you know, like as pretend Wagner, this is actually fun. I mean, you have to realize that one of the things, you know, the people I work with have a great sense of humor, so there's a lot of laughing going on as well. You know, hey, what do you think of the pretend Wagner? We don't take it so seriously all the time. You know, and then we take it very seriously. The hand on the wheat and what Lisa is doing, I mean, it's very serious. Or you know, the whole Lisa Gerrard thing, it was really Pietro's idea. It was my idea that we needed to go and extend the front and have a woman's voice, and it should be, there should be some sort of a poetic thing, you know. And Pietro had this CD of Lisa's, and, you know, it was absolutely fantastic. And I phoned up, I never met her before. And, you know, I phoned in Melbourne and saying, would you like to come do this movie with me? And she goes, oh yeah, great. What is it? And I said, well, it's this Ridley Scott movie. Oh, great. With Russell Crowe. And then she said, no, I don't think I can do it. And I didn't, why did she turn us down? And it was before The Insider had been released. And all she was doing was thinking, oh, poor Russell. He's going to have two movies out, and every time you see Russell Crowe on screen, you hear Lisa Gerrard, you know, singing. So she was just being kind. And so I went back to Ridley, and I was, you know, I said, she turned us down. And he goes, let's send her some footage, you know, which you should never do. Can you imagine in this day and age of the internet actually sending footage to somebody you never met? And he sent her the footage. It didn't end up on the internet. And, you know, like, she phoned back and goes, okay, I'm in. And she came over and we started, we had a great time working on her bits. You know, one of the first things we did was, you know, when Russell finds, when he comes home and he finds his dead wife, and Lisa and I, we literally, she was on this couch and I was just playing and we had the picture up and we were transported by Ridley's images and we'd written this really heartfelt thing. And we thought it was absolutely a masterpiece, and Adam Smalley, our music editor, came in. We showed him this thing and he said, don't you think it's great? He goes, I don't know. I don't think Ridley's going to like it. Oh, you're so wrong. I know Ridley's going to like it. And then in the evening, Ridley came in and we showed him the thing and he's going, it doesn't have enough, energy, sexual thing, And he's smoking his big cigars. He doesn't smoke anymore. He used to smoke these huge cigars. And all I kept thinking was, Lisa's voice. You can't smoke cigars around singers. And we just got into this whole conversation about what it should be and what it isn't. And, And at 2 a.m., she said, Ridley is still, the room is now blue with smoke. And she goes, okay, I'm going to give it one shot. And she just gets in front of the mic and we just literally start improvising to the scene. And she just does one take. And it was like, from some prime evil place inside her. And she looks at Ridley and she goes, is that okay? He's just like, because it was so overwhelming, the force. But I mean, those are the fun parts, that's how it works. Music is indefensible. I mean, those are the fun parts. That's how it works. Music is indefensible. My big fear is that, because it's expensive, that the idea of the orchestra will die, And look, the record business is gone, and really honestly, how often could Deutsche Grammophon or Decca re-record, Mozart's Kleine Nachtmusik, So it's about writing new stuff. And I don't think people really realize that one of the important things about Hollywood is that it commissions not just one, but like countless pieces for orchestral music every day. And so it keeps a tradition, it keeps a whole thing alive, which is, I think, really rather important. I think we would be in a sort of slightly sad world if it was all synthesizers and if you didn't have the possibility anymore of some kid being beaten through its violin lessons and then suddenly discovering that it's actually something really great and that they don't get the chance anymore to play in an orchestra. That the tradition of orchestras goes away. So I'm just trying to be a little protective of that. And so by reinventing how orchestras sound all the time, or doing things additionally with electronics or whatever it is, so keeping that sound fresh, so nobody can ever say, oh, it just sounds like boring classical music, which isn't boring, but just making sure that it doesn't die. I suppose why I say things, there are still 1,000 mysteries left in the orchestra that nobody's heard, just because one or two people might go, oh, I want to hear those.
Do you see that, sehen Sie die Gefahr, dass die Orchester auch eingehen können?
Klar. Of course. I mean, look, it's really expensive. It's very expensive to maintain an orchestra. It's, let alone the work or the, you need a hall. You usually need a large piece of real estate in a very expensive part of town, usually. I mean, think about it like that. And to become a musician, people always are going on how doctors and lawyers, they study for so long, they work so hard before they can be lawyers or doctors. Musicians start when they're 3 years old and they work, they practice forever. So it's not like something that seems, plus it doesn't seem to be a natural career path because most musicians are incredibly broke and not really good marriage material. So the downside is vast, and people not going to You know, there's a vast amount of snobbery as well between classical music, you know, and whatever the thing is we do, we film composers with our entertainment. But at the same time, you know, people aren't being drawn to the orchestra anymore. It's not like they, you know, they want to go and see a U2 concert and they don't want to go and see an orchestral concert. And I think, in a funny way, if we film composers can help to revitalize this or keep it alive, you know, Howard Shore traveling around the world doing the Lord of the Rings thing, you know, the other ring cycle. I mean, that's a great thing. And instinctively, and, you know, I'm trying to be cautious about this because, of course, I love it because I'm a musician, but I think the world wouldn't be such a good place anymore if we didn't have orchestras, or if we didn't have the possibilities of that anymore. Because something very specific happens when you have an orchestra playing, and it's an experience that very few places you can get it. It's 100 people aiming like a laser beam the same emotion in the same direction, and it's a very powerful thing. And if you go and see an orchestra, it's mind-blowing sometimes. It's absolutely mind-blowing that you can have this experience, you know, and the sense of humanity and community that sort of gives you, you know, it's not the internet. You know, it's something different. Okay, I'll move forward.
So ein großes Orchester, also nein, nicht zu dirigieren, aber eben sozusagen sie mit Stoff zu versorgen, sozusagen, und dann das eigene auch zu hören, wenn 50, 60 Leute dann das zum Leben erwecken. Wie ist das?
You know, the weird thing is, because by the time I get to the orchestra sessions, I'm so burnt, I'm so tired, I'm so worried about so many other things that for the first few hours, I'm just happy they're getting through it, and I'm just happy that they're not taking the music and throwing it on the floor and going, we're not going to play this crap. And, you know, somewhere in the middle of the recording, there usually happens a moment where you go, oh, yeah, great playing. But, you know, there's a sort of a disassociation that happens when I'm with the orchestra, whereby they're not playing my music. And, you know, how pretty is my music or something like this. I'm strictly there for them to play the music for this movie, and it's not... I'm there to encourage them, and I'm much more focused on them having a good time and them really being able to go and deliver performance. So it's not about, you know, it feels great that they're playing my music. Sometimes it feels dreadful that they're playing my music, you know, when it doesn't quite work out. But that's the only time when you really think, oh God, what have I done? But the thrill is to be amongst the musicians. You know, the thrill is to be, it is. You know, directors are very envious of what I do because, you know, when a director does a crowd scene with 100 people, it's like shambles for the longest time. Nobody knows what they're doing, and they're all over, like doing the battle scene in Gladiator. I mean, that wasn't easy. You know, and then Ridley comes in. And I got a 100-piece orchestra, and they all sit down, and they open the music, and they play it right away. They sight-read the whole thing. And the first time through, it sounds like a performance. It sounds like music, you know. You won't believe it, but it sounds like music. And it's you know, and partly I'm trying to make it a great experience for the director as well. You know, I mean, a truly sort of, in a way, it's the last thing he has to do. It's the last thing that's really going to affect his movie. So, you know, there's some responsibility there. You know, you don't want to go and ruin the movie by your crazy, clever ideas. you know, and I do come to the orchestra sessions very prepared. You know, no stone has been left unturned. But it's really, you know, I want them to, you know, to play for the director a bit as well. You know, a little, let him have a good time. The turning points, you know, being born is a good one. That's an important thing. Having parents that encourage you to listen to music, you know, I mean, going to my first opera when I was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years old, you know, and loving it, you know. Being surrounded by a lot of music, you know, going to school in England, because there was a completely different way of looking at, I think, looking at human beings than the German school system or the German mentality, where everybody in my day certainly assumed you were an idiot to begin with. While in England, you had to prove that you were an idiot, you know, so they give you the benefit of the doubt, you know. So that was very surprising, you know, and that sort of the more relaxed freedom, you know, England had. Doing A World Apart was sort of good to get my teeth into. Yeah, you know, Rain Man, of course Rain Man was a huge step. But, you know, I think the bigger part of that was to arrive here and see how willing people were at, you know, supporting ideas and helping you and just, you know, I, rather than coming to Hollywood and thinking it was about, it's impossible to do things, which is, you know, really what we come a bit from that in our European tradition, where everybody tells us, no, you can't do that, you know, or it's too expensive, or it's too crazy, or who's going to see this like this, whatever, you know, that the idea of no, or a culture of no. While here it really was quite the opposite. You know, Hollywood gets accused of being repetitive. Of course it's repetitive, but at the same time, if somebody comes up with a new idea, if Chris Nolan wants to come and do Inception, okay, it might have taken him 10 years to go and do Inception, but eventually he'll get it done. Eventually somebody will go, yeah, that, you know, that is interesting to do now. And I'm not sure if Chris, if he had done it 7 years ago, let's say, I don't know if he would have done as good a movie as well. But I find, you know, I mean, the surprising thing after Europe was, you know, how welcoming this place really was, you know, and how prepared to take chances it was. Lion King was, of course, you know, it was huge, especially because I did it for all the wrong reasons. I mean, I did it for my daughter because I wanted to show off as dad, and, you know, I was doing all these grown-up movies where people were getting killed, and I couldn't take her to a premiere. I wanted to do something to take my kid to a premiere. And it was, you know, and it was surprisingly emotional doing that movie. You know, it deals with a father's death, so, you know, it's got a lot more depth than the surface let me believe, and it shocked me, my own response, you know, once I started writing on it, because I was thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be easy, that it, you know, and it wasn't like it was hard, but the emotional involvement suddenly became, you know, profound as opposed to hard, you know. And really, it was Lion King that got Terry Malick interested in me, for instance. You know, Terry loved Lion King and wanted me to do Thin Red Line. So, you know, all these things are, you know, working with Ridley Scott. I mean, we've done some really good movies together, and they're stylistically so different. I mean, Black Rain is so different from Thelma and Louise, is so different from Gladiator, so different from Hannibal, is so different from Black Hawk Down, is so different from Matchstick Men. I'm sure I'm leaving some out. So, you know, working with people who are like me, that, you know, they get a little bored doing the same thing, and you know, off they go to try to do something completely different. I mean, that's you know, that's a big part of it.
What do you think of that, Steve?
You wow alone. Didn't Hans say, you know, there's no excuse for music? Well, Nicholas, please, there's no excuse for music.
Yeah. Yeah, what was he thinking? Violin isn't a piece of technology? Just kidding.
Yeah,
of course it is.
Yeah, it totally is.
I guess I should have guessed as much, but I didn't realize that old Hansi was such a technocrat.
Yeah, well, you know, he came of age in a certain era, right? And I imagine, like, when he was a young person, like, Tangerine Dream was probably the biggest band in Germany, right? Like, that's the situation.
Yeah, just, you know, full believer. I will say, you know, in agreement with Hans, these days I tend to prefer musical recordings to live performances. How about you, Steve?
Yeah, almost entirely. I mean, the scent of live music is itself so repugnant. You can smell it clinging to musicians. When you walk by a musician, you can smell the fetid odor on their bodies, and it's just the worst.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
I mean, it's kind of easy to say. I feel like music, or at least musical recordings, are the reason that musicians have been transformed into shapeless apes and pencil-head jerks. But, you know, like our other guest, John Mouse, has proven, sometimes it's best to speak the language of your time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, I think the question really is what about your time? You know, I think a decent argument could be made that depending on the character of your time, it might be better for one to choose silence. You know, just putting that out there, just saying.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Choose squash.
I've always loved krautrock, which, you know, for those of you that don't know, old Hansi comes from Cluster.
He doesn't.
And a bunch of other krautrock bands from Germany.
He's never been in Cluster.
Before he moved to LA and became like...
No.
Like next to John Williams, one of the biggest film and TV composers.
That's true.
In Hollywood, which is always kind of a shock because what I loved about krautrock was... it's kind of like Dutch still life painting, you know, where you had this long tradition of painters trained in this completely insane technique of realist painting, and then with the birth of the capitalist marketplace, they then turn their gaze and they turn the gaze secular. they aim this technique at a different object. And to me, krautrock was something similar. You know, this long tradition of really intricate German harmony, then kind of turning away from the stuffy romanticism that came before it, and exploring ideas like drug hallucination and liberation.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe the more important detail is that, like, synthesizer technology, electronic music technology was monophonic for the most part, and polyphony was restricted. So harmony itself had to occupy a completely different place, right, in the electronic turn that krautrock is sort of known for. I think also the fact that it was a small market. You know, Germany was not that big a prize compared to other markets. And so therefore it was a relatively easy playground environment. And then they had subsequently all the technology available, right? Like Kahn got to record with a huge, absolutely huge mixing desk, the kind of thing that, you know, only like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones are recording with in more economically precocious parts of the world. They just picked it up from WDR Köln when Stockhausen was done with it. You know, like this incredibly technically advanced material, these incredible microphones, all of this stuff was all just being made in Germany, just floating around. If you knew a guy who knew a guy, you could get a hold of this stuff and produce these kinds of records. Whereas, you know, if you were doing the same thing in North America, you had to rely on some sort of Svengali-like dickhead who would fund the studio apparatus. Like, so there you get guys like Kim Fowley, who are just these like rotten pedophiles running these games for, you know, recording studios as these bizarre clown shows, right? And, but they control the means of production. Whereas in Germany, the means of production was far more available to people with experimental leanings, and there was no economic throttle taking record producing out of the hands of experimentalists. So I think it was like a perfect storm, really, in the sense of like how and why krautrock. I do think, however, that you know, there is no excuse for music. I'm just going to say it again. There's no excuse for music.
I'm not saying it worked. I didn't suspect it would end up leading towards, you know, backing tracks for Batman. I don't know. What are your feelings on krautrock, Steve?
I love it, but I feel like you're confusing Hans Zimmer with Michael Baumann, who also moved to California but now runs a New Age charitable foundation, and was formerly in Tangerine Dream and sort of a crypto member of Cluster for a while. He produced a bunch of records.
Yeah.
You are.
Well put. Well, you know, Mr. Zimmer went on for quite a while. He has a lot to say, or had a lot to say. Probably has even more. So we won't keep you any longer. But thanks, Hans. Thanks for coming all the way over here. I'm sure you'll enjoy that tunnel, that new tunnel to LAX. Good morning, Chinatown.
Namaste.